Welcome to Two Dudes, One God Podcast. We are back with a re-recorded episode with Izzy Gentry. I'm Trey Thetford, your host, with Pat Lacey and Izzy Gentry.
Hi.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. We've got a lot of things to talk about today. And first of all, Izzy, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us kind of who you are?
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me on. I'm super excited to get to chat with you guys. I have developed over the last 5 years a crisis management strategy that's biblically based. So we've been working with nonprofit organizations and churches to develop their leadership skills and help to train volunteers to be able to help individuals when they're in need to have the structure, because sometimes they're not always equipped to deal with difficult conversations. And so that's really been my heart and passion. That's what made Made to Walk develop. And so we've developed an app and resources and a workbook for leadership to be able to do training with their churches and with their organization to help to develop those conversations.
That's cool. So you have had a lot of hats. You've got like an event planning business, and you've got this Made to Walk organization that you have, and you're the outgoing president of the Smith County Republican Club.
I am. I have been wearing this hat all year, but I've really been a part of the club for the last 8-10 years. Mm-hmm. So it's just a perfect time for me to transition out. I'm really proud of the work we did this year, and obviously we had some really big wins. So I feel like I'm always the kind of person that I enjoy leaving on top, and this is an opportunity for new leadership to come in. But yeah, over the last decade or so, I've developed two different companies, and they've been successful here in East Texas, so I've been really privileged.
That's cool. And you used to be a professional singer on YouTube and MTV?
Trey's favorite secret of mine, yes. Right out of high school, I loved performing arts. I went to a performing arts high school in Orange County, California. It's where I'm originally from.
And with some famous people, right? You were there with famous people?
Yes, I got to hang out with plenty of famous people. I used to open for Miguel and...
Miguel?
Yeah. He's an R&B artist. He's kind of known in that realm. But so I've performed at every major venue on the Sunset Strip, which is my pride and joy. I mean, those are very famous stages that people like Led Zeppelin and others have stepped on. So it's like kind of like holy ground, but in the music industry. So I feel like I kind of got that out of my system and moved on to other things.
All right, here we go. We're going to rewind real quick, take a quick musical dance party break, and go back 15 years ago to the artist formerly known as Elizabeth Ashley. Enjoy. You're welcome, Izzy. Everybody's down on the beach, shirts off, and we turn the volume up. I stand up and show up, listen to the sound of the new dance underground. You did those things. Like growing up, your parents were involved in a big mega church. And so can you talk to us about your salvation story or how you ended up being a believer?
Yeah. So I was a pastor's kid. My parents had been in ministry since I was born. Essentially, I was a miracle baby. My parents have strong conversion stories and were told that they were never going to be able to have any more kids. So me and my older sister are 8 years apart. And so when they found out they were pregnant with me, they named me Elizabeth, which means a gift from God. And so they went into the ministry full time. My dad felt like that was something he owed God. And so that's pretty much how I knew him for the first, 30 years of my life. And it was really interesting to kind of watch the flow of that ministry. He started off just being a janitor and worked his way up. He really believed in servanthood. And eventually he went to plant a church in Colorado and came back to be on staff at a mega church and was there for quite some time until he really found that the ministry was taking over his ministry at home. And he just was not participating in that matter. So by the time we had kids, it was really important for him to be a part of his grandchildren's life. So it was just time for him to take a sabbatical and take a different stage in life. And I'm really grateful for both aspects of my life because he was such a great representation. My mother was a great representation of that biblical-based studying and the things that they brought us up in. But with that, I was always this kid that always just kind of like, I don't know, kicked the heels of everyone else. So I was the freshman that refused to tell her testimony because I just believed that we didn't have a testimony at such a young age. And I felt like there was such an emphasis in the 90s into the early 2000s that was pushing people into having this testimony. And I was like, are we almost encouraging people to be a drug addict or to go to prison or to whatever to have that conversion story? I don't understand why we're pushing this so hard.
Boomers love that, though. The boomers love the like the big, powerful story and the invocation and bring somebody down and we're going to have a baptism. You know, they, not that baptism's bad, but like they really want that.
Yeah, it's, there's like an emotional compellingness to it, but then we lacked the ability to disciple those that we were converting. And I could see that in real time. Like I was just seeing these mega productions of people coming forward and my dad was very into the discipleship and he was very into the difference between being anointed and appointed. And so he really wanted to make sure that like if somebody was giving marital advice that they knew what they were doing, you know, and so on and so forth. And so he took on all those hard ministries like drug and alcohol rehabilitation and inner city, you know, communications and stuff like that, because he just felt like those were really important crisis centered things that he wanted to make sure that people who are qualified were handling well. So I got to see him do things really well. And then I kind of saw people drop the ball along the way. And it wasn't until I started to experience my own difficulties when I was a freshman in high school. I was molested in the church. And immediately I realized that the world doesn't want your testimony when the pain comes from inside the church.
Like in the church and like while church was going on or?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. By a member or by like a?
By another associate pastor. Wow. So it was really difficult.
How do you deal with that? Like what, did you tell your parents? Did you tell somebody else?
Actually, yeah. So my cousin was actually one who, she noticed some of those signs and symptoms that I teach and train in now when we're talking about trafficking, just behavioral changes from your baseline, and she knew something wasn't right. She told her mom, which was the right thing to do, and her mom then went on to tell my parents that they felt something was wrong, and she confronted me, and I kind of told her what was going on. And it became a big legal thing, and I went through the legal aspect of it. So I went through all of the legality of filing the charges and whatnot, and I really saw the church come against me for doing that.
Wait. So like your cousin told your aunt told your parents talked to you, and you were like, yeah, this happened.
Yes.
And they were like, what?
So immediately we went into, I can't get into all of the specifics, but essentially, and because it involved the FBI, it involved like a sting operation. It was very extensive.
Whoa.
So essentially what needed to happen was we started the prosecution process. And in the beginning, I think there's a portion of empathy, but also confusion. And then it very much goes into self-preservation. And
this on the church's part.
Yeah, this is what a lot of churches do. And I think people just in and of themselves too, like individual families, they're like, we don't know how involved we want to get. You know, like, I don't know if I need to be involved in this. But I mean, it's not any different than someone finding out that, you know, somebody's husband got arrested, you know, or, you know, some.
I mean, it's pretty different. Like one of the associate pastors. Daughters.
No, I mean like in the sense that like families will withdraw.
Sure. Got it.
We don't know the whole story, so we're not going to get involved.
Well, like how did you deal with that stuff? Did you go to counseling?
As a kid, I was really angry at the church. Like I just was like, I never turned away from God, which.
That's pretty unique.
I could compartmentalize at a very young age the difference between humanity and God.
Mm-hmm.
think I just knew that God had me. And I think that I knew that because I saw him. I knew him from the Bible.
Like, you experienced him.
Yes. Yeah. And I truly knew him. Like, it's one thing for us to, like, talk about Jesus, mm-hmm. talk about God. But, like, I truly understood his behavior. So, like, I knew he was a God of wrath. And I knew that he was a God of justice. And I knew he was a God of protection. So, like, I just knew he had me. But I was also, like, but if you feel the need to burn them down, like, you know, like, you can also do that. Like,
I'm calling fire down right now. Yeah, I'm like, at any moment,
you can just do your thing. My enemy is, yeah. like, I understood David's prayers, like, a whole lot. Yeah. Like, you know, but, and so I got so much negative volunteer engagement advice during that time that just deterred me from the church. It was like immediately after everything happened, people are like, you need to forgive and you can't be angry because anger is a sin. And I was like, I haven't even processed what's happened to me. I'm a child. Like, I don't know what's next for me. Yeah. It was very public. It was very, it was just very complicated. And so essentially I had to process in real time who God was to me. And I can say with confidence that my relationship at 14 years old and my relationship at 24 years old and my relationship at 34 years old look violently different in those stages. And it really wasn't until I had my son and I started going to a Methodist church that I had ever even heard of the sanctification process. Like, that wasn't something I grew up with. And so I loved the idea of leaning in towards perfection, but that I didn't have to be perfect. You know, that I was moving towards being more and more like Christ every day. And that was okay because I knew that the stages of my hurt and my confusion and all of these things were natural and they were a part of just how God makes us. So they couldn't have been bad. And I felt like so many people wanted me to feel bad about how I felt, which only helped to develop what I do now, because I never wanted somebody to feel like that. I was like, how can we wrap people with knowledge to help them to help victims who go through difficult situations in their life understand the processes of grief and understand the processes of trauma and secondary trauma and just so many other things that we don't talk about, survivor's guilt, all kinds of things. And so it created a passion in me, and I think God allowed it to happen so that I could tell my story someday and help other people through processes.
Well, what a cool deal. I mean, I was thinking about Joseph, and we had like a series on Joseph at our church, and they were talking about, you know, but God was with him, you know, and all these bad things kept happening to him. And he was like, but he knew that God was with him. And then the question comes, like, what would you do? How would you behave if you knew that God was with you? It's interesting to me that throughout your life, you're telling us that, like, you've always kind of known that God was with you.
Yeah. Me and God have always been very good. I will say that there is, like, a big chunk of time where, like, me and Jesus were not cool. I've said this on other podcasts as well. Like, this is not new information. But essentially, Jesus was always painted to me like some, like, 70s hippie that was just like down to hang out with like child molesters and like forgive everyone. And I was like, yeah, me and you are not cool. Like, I don't get you. I don't understand you. I don't want to be anywhere around you. Like, he was just like this all loving, super chill person that was illustrated to me. And then I actually read, like, truly read his words. And I was like, that's not who he was.
Yeah.
Not even like remotely who he was. And so I learned to understand how he brought people into the truth, but that his words were very poignant and they were actually very offensive and they were very direct. Very
polarizing.
Yeah.
Extremely polarizing. And I was like, that I can relate to. That's more of a person I can
say. Have you read or watched the movie The Shack?
Yes.
So I haven't read the book, but like I watched the movie and I was immediately offended by some of the portrayals. And then it hit me and I was like, oh, you know, but I think about that. Like when you say that, like you weren't cool with Jesus for a while, like I get it, you know, like things happen in life and we can't explain it. We don't even have enough space on a bookshelf to file the things away that happen, you know, because the earth is, the world's fallen, Like where this is not where we're meant to be forever.
I heard like the most ridiculous criticisms of that book, and even the movie. Like it was portrayed, you know, at one point God is speaking through a woman, and so they're like, well, God's not a woman. And I just was like, you're missing the point. Like, you don't understand trauma. When God wants to speak, he's going to illustrate himself in whichever way that would be necessary in the moment. Some people go through horrific traumas with their dad being super abusive. So, like, a man being a super authoritative is probably not the best way that they're going to receive information. Mm-hmm. Maybe a woman is like, been abandoned by her mother, and a woman comes along and wants to teach her the Bible, maybe she's not going to receive that. You can't really define how a person processes trauma. It's what's more important is that they get the picture. And I think as Christians, we want to sit here and articulate exactly that it's supposed to be the kind of ideology that fits our own narrative and our own perspective of what it should look like. And God's just bigger than that.
Well, I mean, I think we've seen a big swing in the church over the last several years. I think we're in the middle of a real revival and a reshaping of the boomer, you know, theology and the boomer kind of way that things have been done in church and relationships. So it's exciting. I think you're part of that movement with your organization, you know? So there's some things there that, you know, we can touch on. Pat, you've got something, buddy?
No, I'm honestly studying right now. I'm just looking over Jesus' words. So I guess one of the things, whenever you said that, you know, you and Jesus weren't cool, I went through that stage also, and it's because like I just didn't read his word. And I thought that Jesus literally like popped up out of nowhere, and then all of a sudden he's like, I don't know, like manifesting this idea that he's the Son of God and everything like that. But whenever you actually go in and you start to see what Jesus actually said, like he doesn't separate himself from the Word of God. Mm-hmm. He affirms the Word of God in every aspect. Mm-hmm. And, right here, where was it? John 5. It says, then Jesus answered and said unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself but what he seeth the Father do, for what things soever he hath done, these also doeth the Son likewise. So literally Jesus is saying, like, you know who my Father is? Whenever he showed up in Israel at the time, you know, everybody was always looking for the Messiah, the whole history of Israel. I think since God started mentioning things about the Messiah, about even back in Leviticus 18, you go into Isaiah, like you go into the prophets, you start to see them prophesying this root, this stump of Jacob that's supposed to be coming up. Jesus is really just affirming what his Father said the entire time. And the more and more that you start to look into what it is that Jesus said that he was doing, the fact that he fulfilled the ritual laws, the fact that he fulfilled all the festivals, the fact that he fulfilled the sacrificial laws, the fact that he fulfilled even like down to the point where in the Old Testament, the lamb was to be delivered to the high priest. Even down to Jesus, whenever he was in the garden and he was arrested, who is he delivered to? The high priest of Israel. Like he was brought right there. And that's kind of the providence of God, that I see in scripture more and more. So, I like that you touched on the fact that, you know, you have to actually read his word. You can't separate Jesus from his word.
That's exactly it. When we're like raising our kids up in the Lord, it's so important for them to understand, or I constantly emphasize with my kids is like, don't look to me. Like,
right.
I'm going to fail you. I'm going to disappoint you. I'm going to do all the things. You have to know who God is, and you have to know his behaviors, and you have to know what he does and who he is. And anytime that you question me, my son said this to me, actually shared it at the president's dinner, we had Senator Ted Kurz there, and you know, it was so funny because my son came to me one day and he said, "Mommy, you never lose a fight." And immediately I thought, oh my gosh, what does this kid see me do? Like, you know, like I can be a very argumentative person. I thought, okay, what bad behaviors is he seeing? And so I very, you know, hesitantly asked, I was like, why do you say that? And he goes, because every time that you get in an argument, you always say, go get my Bible. And I thought, that is so cool. Yes, yeah, cool. Like I was so like, oh, thank God that's what you got from that. And it's so true because I'm like, I don't want you to understand like that I've set this rule because it's my rule. I'm setting this rule because it's God's rule. And if you want to argue it, you can take it up with God. And that is what I constantly have to push it back to you, because if they look to me, then they're going to be constantly disappointed. I'm as human as anybody else.
Well, God always uses what you don't have, you know, or like what you actually have rather than what you don't have. I mean, so, you know, the fish and the loaves is the biggest example, the easiest one to come to. But I think that God uses our parents' deficiencies and our deficiencies as parents in order to drive us and our kids to Him. And I think it's interesting that, you know, God doesn't have any grandkids, you know. So if we believe in God and we're trying to follow Jesus' example, then we have to get out of our own kids' way in their relationship with God. Like it's not my responsibility to make sure that my kid understands everything about God. I think God's going to come after him or her just like he came after me, you know?
Right. And he just shows up in ways that we can't even begin to explain. Like there's plenty of instances where I look back and I'm like, wow, God really showed up. And I can't even like begin to fathom the hoops that he went through in his providence, in his understanding, in his knowing, and knowing that I'm not in charge. Mm-hmm. Like that's the real conclusion that I came to a couple of years ago was that, you know, I had all these plans, I had all these dreams, ideas, but the reality is that was my will that I was living after. Mm-hmm. And I knew God, like, don't get me wrong. Like I pursued him. And I wanted to know more and more about him. But I think the conclusion where I realized that I'm not in charge really allowed God to start to move. And I allowed God to start to move more in my life and stop putting him into a box and my own limitations and the things that I wanted, and really gave it over to him.
And I think that it starts and it ends with that when we're having conversations about kids in general. I think that people have this false sense of reality of like, when I have it all together, I'll have children. Mm-hmm. Like when it's perfect timing, like there is no perfect timing.
Yeah, it's like the movie Idiocracy, you know? Yeah,
like if you would have told me that I would have had my kid the way that I did and how it all happened, I would have told you like, no, I would have never imagined that it would happen, but it happened so perfectly because God needed it to happen that way to put me where I needed to be. Like I wouldn't have been in Tyler had it not happened the way that it did. So I just think that when people start to think about their own personal insecurities and flaws, that's not what defines you as purposeful to God. Like he has a purpose for everything.
So what, tell us a little bit about your kids. Like we're in this room right now that is a classroom, very obviously. And like, I recognized it because I was homeschooled myself and I was kind of like baiting. Like I was like, I wonder how much she homeschools. Like,
yeah. So if you would have asked me if I was going to be a homeschool mom, I would have told you absolutely no. Like I had all of the visions of being very involved in school. My son is high functioning autism, my youngest son. And so he was just having a difficulty in school. We moved him to a college preparatory school where he still was having difficulties, and it was not his work ethic. It was that he could get all of his work done in a very short amount of time. He had exceptional test scores, and so he was just bored. And after kind of trying to push him through the rhythm of our expectations of this 8-hour day of being at school and, you know, just sitting still, which is against every boy's, like, you know, personal design. We just were like, this is torture. Why are we doing this? Why is this? This is not what God has designed this kid for. You know, some kids, they are exceptional in school and it's perfect for them. This is not the path for him. All he cares about is going into ministry. It's like, God had a joke when he gave me this child. I was
your
like,
son?
Yes.
Like, really?
I was the kid that was like, get my parents out of ministry. I hate being a pastor's kid. And then I had this child and he's like, I'm going to be a missionary one day. And I was like, why, God? Why? Like, couldn't you have just given me like a kid that just wants to like play basketball all day? And so I've had to like swallow my own, I don't know, pride ambitions or whatever to be that mom for him. But
I mean, he still might be an attorney or something. I mean, you know, like you don't know. He may be an attorney for a church.
Yeah. But he has a heart to learn and to seek Jesus right now. And so I can't tell him that that's less important because it's just not. And so we have participated in Texas Homeschool Coalition over the last couple of years. They have amazing conventions and it has been hugely resourceful for us. And they have such amazing ambassadors who come through there, like Kirk Cameron and others. And so we have gotten to touch and feel a lot of different resources and allow him to pick things that he enjoys. And so we actually do a pretty good amount of work and we just have learned a rhythm. When I first started homeschooling, I was like, okay, we're going to do this like school. I'm going to break up your day exactly like how school. And I was like, this didn't work in school. Why would I think it works at home? You know, like
absolutely.
I was just kicking the wall. And so I figured out that for him in particular, he enjoys doing work later in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. He has no problem doing it like from 3 to 6. He just doesn't want to do it first thing in the morning. That's just not his thing. He'd rather read or he'd rather do other things. He'd rather work on coding. He loves coding. He's gotten into that. So I kind of let him work his wiggles out in the morning and then we start with that process of it. And then he's built some interests and we've gotten some of the big subjects out of the way early on. So when he was just in fifth grade, we started doing seventh grade work, getting it out of the way, Texas history and things like that. And there's no better thing than mom being in politics and getting to take him down to the Alamo several times a year and, you know, take him to conventions and sit with politicians. So he's gotten to be a part of a lot of history and that's what he'll remember.
Do you think that this is the school system. Do you think that things have changed a lot since, I was born in 85. I think Pat's like 8 years younger than I am. And, you know, you're younger a little bit, right?
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to ask women how old they are.
I'm in my mid-30s.
Got it. So you're 43.
No, I'm not.
That was a woman translation. She's not 43. School's changed a lot. And I think it's much more inclusive. And I think it's much more individualized. But I still think that there's a fair amount of judging fish by their ability to fly happening at school. And specifically, I think that there's really a war on boys in school. And I don't think that like here in Smith County, Texas, that it's that crazy yet. You know, there's no litter boxes in the bathroom. And I don't think that, you know, if one of our kids went to a public school here and said, I'm a girl or I'm a boy, that the school would like secretly help them decide to be the opposite sex or whatever. I don't think, but maybe I'm wrong. You know, you're looking at me crazy. They do it here?
There is some of it here. I would agree that it's not as extreme as some of the bigger cities.
It's not like Australia. Australia is like, they're like,
yeah, putting litter boxes in public schools. I mean, they have neutral bathrooms.
Which I'm seeing that more and more. Like,
so I have two bonus children, one that's 20, one that is 16. And from the oldest to the youngest, or I should really just say like the oldest to the middle, one finished high school and the other one went into high school. And so it's a different high school now than even when our oldest was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different place.
Just 4 years different.
And so we saw the trajectory and we were like, there's just no way. Like, there's just no way that Tristan, having the heart and the mindset that he does, is going to survive in the trajectory that the school is going. It is a completely different atmosphere. It's so social experimental at this point. And it, I know in California, when I was there, they were already implementing rules and results that made no sense to me. It was like they had to call mom and dad if you wanted a Tylenol for a headache, but they did not have to call mom and dad if you needed an abortion. The nurse could drive you to go get an abortion and that's not tell mom and dad. And I was like, how does that happen? Like, how do we have such broad rules that allow such harm to be done to children, and we are not being transparent about what these kinds of long-term results can be? That child doesn't have a clue what she's signing up for. And so we are seeing more of it integrate into other things. I'm hoping that seeing how red this last election was, that people understand that people that is not of their top interests. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other things that they're interested in being focused on. How people feel is the least of their concerns at the moment. So I'm hoping to see the identity crisis of the conversation kind of drop down more. But
well, have we turned Maslow's hierarchy of needs upside down? Is that what's happened? Like, we're not like the first thing we're worried about is not shelter and security. The first thing we're worried about is like, do 5-year-olds know if they're a boy or a girl? You know, it's like, what are we doing?
Well, I think from a biblical standpoint, it's like I'm always going to make the argument that it's a worship to Baal. I mean,
yeah,
that is what it is. I mean, we're a culture of people that don't call things for what they are. Like, they're just culture now. But back in the day, it was the worshiping of a different God. Mm-hmm. And when you're sacrificing children and you're mutilating children, I mean, that is a very intentional thing that is biblically sound to the worship of Baal. And you could see that even when the prophet is like, you call on your God and I'll call on my God and we'll see which one starts a fire.
Yeah.
And when they couldn't, they start slitting themselves and cutting themselves and, you know, doing what they can. I mean, mutilation is very much a part of that demonic entity. And so, I mean, obviously if you're outside of Christendom, you're going to make the argument that it's other things. But in my world, I think the Bible is pretty sound about what it is.
Well, like if you're going 45 miles an hour down the street out here and you get pulled over and you think the speed limit's 45 and the cop walks up and goes, I stopped you because you're going 45 and a 35. To protect yourself, to defend yourself against that ticket, the defense is not, well, I thought it was 45. Because ignorance of the truth, ignorance of the law is not a defense against the reality of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what we're dealing with is a society that's concerned about ethics instead of biblical, real morals. And I think that true law really comes from God. And if you look at our founding documents, you know, the inalienable rights that we have, we acquired from God, and the government acknowledges them and says, hey, we're not going to overstep these rights that came from your creator.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in a situation where people are like, well, separation of church and state. And I'll give you that. I honestly don't believe it's the government's business who I sleep with, who I marry, you know, how I live my life, as long as I'm not infringing on somebody else's rights. But I also am a Jesus follower, and I believe that it's wrong to kill people, period. So I guess we could segue this into talking about abortion, and I guess I'll go first. I met the mother of my daughter the night before I turned 21, and in pretty short order, got her pregnant, didn't know it, broke up with her. And then she knocked on the door and was like, I'm pregnant. And I was like, no, you're not. Because I thought it was like this elaborate hoax. And then I thought about it. And I thought, you know, she had the picture, you know, the sonogram picture. And it wasn't like the cool ones they have today. It was just like a little white dot in space or something, you know. And I was like, I don't know about this. And I hadn't given a lot of thought to like what your options might be if you got somebody pregnant. I wasn't trying to get her pregnant. And, you know, she was like, I'm not going to have an abortion. And I was like, well, I don't think you should have an abortion. And I was like, but maybe adoption. you know, like adoption might be good. Like, I'm not finished with college. You're not even in college. What are we? We're not even together. Like, this is a pretty bad situation to bring a kid into. She told everybody, I told her she had to have an abortion, and that's not what I said. And then we ended up dating later and, you know, had a kid, and we've had a couple of expensive long custody battles. And I say all that to say this. My daughter being born and me choosing to be an active part in her life for sure did not end my life. And in some instances has sustained my life and given me purpose and reason to move forward, because I've had some real hardship in life where I even, you know, was in such a dark spot that I was like, I could probably kill myself. Mm-hmm. And then like the thing that drew me back was like, but what would my daughter do? Mm-hmm. You know? And so I'm in a good position now. And like, my daughter lives with me. We have a great relationship. And I could not imagine life without her. But I think in that moment when I had that knock on the department door and she was like, I'm pregnant, my initial gut feeling was, oh no, my life is over. Mm-hmm. You know? And I'm sure that my daughter's going to listen to this, and she's listened to all these episodes. She thinks it's funny, I think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you're listening to this and you're in high school and you're a virgin or you're thinking about having sex, just think about having to figure out this problem of how am I going to care for another human being? So I empathize with people that are thinking about having an abortion, but no matter how you got to be pregnant, whether it was good, bad, really terrible, rape, incest, I don't think that murdering another human life fixes that for you. And I don't think that it helps you to avoid further trauma. The problem with life is it gives you the test and then you get the lesson. We don't know the cost of the decisions we make every time when we make the decision. Sometimes you figure that out later. And as a counselor, as a Christian, and just a human being, I've had some run-ins with this thing of abortion. And the clients that I've had that have had an abortion, no matter they were a believer or not, were haunted by the abortion. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we talk about that stuff enough. And I think I've said plenty. What do y'all have anything to add to this discussion? I guess I'll say one more thing. If you've had an abortion, there's a good chance that you feel guilt or shame about it. And I'm here to say that like Jesus died on the cross for your sins. So guilt is I've done bad. Shame is I am bad. And I don't think that shame is a good place to be, you know? But I think that the idea of women's medical care or women's rights really translating to, oopsie, I didn't want to have a baby, so I'll just kill this one. I think that's a bad deal. And there's a weight to that when you make that decision.
And you can't call it medical anything if we're not being transparent. I mean, if you sign up for a surgery, you have to have like a pre-op visit, and they say, you know, here are the potential risks of that situation. They're going to say, you know, here's the aftercare. They're going to be really honest with you. For whatever reason, when we get specifically to abortion, we don't talk about post-abortion syndrome, which is the same DSM-5 rating as post-traumatic stress disorder. So if we are dealing with veterans with PTSD, we should be very much communicating these same risks and the potential of long-term risks, because it can increase addiction, hallucination, suicidal thoughts, disassociation, just rage. So much anger, and all of these things are a process of what they were told that this was going to be a good thing. This was going to be the open door to the rest of their life. It was going to keep them from giving up their future and their education and like all of the things. And then they're dealing with all of this emotional aspect, and they're like, why do I feel this way? Well, you feel that way because your body doesn't know that the trauma you put it through was willingly. Mm.
it only knows trauma. Like, your body went through a loss. So you can tell yourself all day long, I wanted this, I made this choice, I'm happy about it, but your body doesn't know how to process that. It's the same kind of reality is that trauma is trauma. So when we're talking about an individual who's already made that decision, there's the reality of her trauma is present, but it's manageable. It's something that God can redeem 100%. Mm-hmm. Because there's nothing about going through something traumatic that's unredeemable, just the same way as if you have to go through, you know, public scrutiny or, you know, public embarrassment for anything else. There's so many things that cause that trauma. And sometimes it's secondary trauma. It's just watching someone else that you love go through something. You know, we...
And not being willing to speak up about the situation. Because there's a scene, you were talking about Baal worship in the Old Testament. And it actually says... and if any man should close his eyes and look away when... somebody is throwing their offspring into the fires of Baal, he will be receiving the same judgment as if they would have thrown it in personally. And that is an accountability that God puts forth. And he's like, you can't just close your eyes to this. You can't just like shut off. You can't just say, oh, well, it's, and I am a firm believer that Christians need to be speaking up about this issue a lot more than they are. And we've heard it through the years, and all the rhetoric that goes with it, that, you know, you're just supposed to love them, blah, 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 blah. And yes, absolutely, you are supposed to love the person, but you're also supposed to tell them what it is that God actually says about this situation.
You're supposed to bring them into the truth. That's what Jesus did. He didn't. They're like, well, Jesus sat among sinners. I'm like, yes, but he also said, turn from your sin and sin no more. He didn't say like, and carry on, you know, like,
continue.
You've had 5 abortions, have 5 more.
Yeah.
You know, like, we need these are rookie numbers.
The woman that he saves from being stoned. I mean, it's like this very dramatic emphasis on who he is and the compassion and mercy and grace that he has. But he said, like, it's very clear, go and sin no more. It's not a redemption with grace and then just you're good. Mm. You have to put something into it as well. You have to give up that thing that is keeping you from the continual grace and love and desire that he has for the future of your life. You can't continue to live in sin and then think that you're going to reap the benefits of life.
What's like the last Exorcist movie that came out? Like the little girls like went down into this thing and then like invited the demons in, you know? And, you know, look, to be saved, to be redeemed by Jesus, you have to invite him in, you know? It's a decision. This guy broke up with me. He's in and out of jail. I'm just going to have an abortion. I'm not in a position to bring this child into the world. That to me is so sad. Somehow the idea that you're doing the child that you're going to kill a service by not having...
It's a really common narrative. I actually tell our conservative leaders to stop using the phrase to be personally responsible. Because personal responsibility is... You were mentioning ethics earlier. And I would make the argument that those that are misusing the idea of ethics will manipulate it, right? Like they're taking advantage of the idea of ethics, because ethics really is like a threefold. It's what is the most ethical thing for me? What is the most ethical thing for us? And then what is the most ethical thing for everyone? That's kind of how you have to look at it. And you can take a lot of liberties into a lot of different places with it. But when we're talking about personal responsibility, they believe that the ethical thing that they're doing is not putting a pressure on society by forcing a child to be in the foster care system, which is, you know, dependent on the government to take care of. They think, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to put myself through that and then keep me from being educated and having a good job to be able to give back to society. Like, there's a lot of rationale that goes into it. Don't always think that someone who is out there getting an abortion, I think we have to stop using the narrative that they're just selfish and they just don't want to have a baby. there are people who very much, they're like, I'm proud of my abortion, blah, blah, blah. And like, they're, I mean, that's a whole different spiel of characterization, but.
What do you think that is? Do you think that's being callous to the sin, or do you think that that's trying to convince themselves and hype themselves up that it's not bad?
I think it's a lot more about themselves than it is about anybody else. I mean, if you go through anything else in your life, you don't go screaming about it into the.
Well, I think that, like, I've dealt with this some. I'm in the insurance business, and so sometimes I ask people, like, have you ever had COVID? Have you ever had a heart attack? Have you ever had a stroke? And, like, there's two kinds of people. There's the people that I deal with mostly that are like, no, I never had that. And then, like, I'll get their medical report back, and I'm like, bud, you've been taking this heart medicine. Like, you didn't know that you were taking a heart medicine? Mm-hmm. Then I've got, like, what I like to call the Medicaid mindset people. The people that like stub their toe and go to the ER, the people that have a small cold and go to the ER because like they're on Medicaid. And I'll sit down with them. You ever had a heart attack? Yep. I've had 3 heart attacks. You take any medicine for that? They're like, hold on. They'll come out with like a basket, like a laundry basket full of medication. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, the way you get on this much medication is you go to the doctor constantly. And once you get on one med, then you get on another one and then another one. And if you're listening to this, I'm not saying don't take your medicine, but there's some people that are just like bragging about how sick they are, right?
And the person who keeps running to the doctor or the doctors who keep pushing the medications.
Yeah, like drug dealers wouldn't exist if drug users didn't need to buy the drugs, you know? Right. So like we're very much in a society of like, if there's a pill or an operation I can take, even an injection, like give it to me so that I can fix it. Right. And so, you know, like we're not going to eat healthy and work out 5 days a week for 9 months to get the body we want. We're going to go have all the fat sucked out and have some of the skin removed. You know, we're not going to eat a healthy diet that our body needs. We're going to get the semaglutide, whatever that stuff is, Ozempic or whatever. That's what we want, you know?
And I think there's a certain level of indoctrination that has taken place that has really pushed that idea of you need to do this. You need to talk to the doctor. You need to do all that. And I'm not saying don't go to the doctor by any means, but also there's people who work within the abortion industry that really push things onto people. I was actually just talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and she has a 15-year-old now, and she actually went and got her sonogram done at Planned Parenthood in California. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was told, you know, they give free women's health care. They give all this free stuff and make sure that you're able to have your baby whenever you want to. And she went in there and they did the sonogram and everything and listened to the heartbeat. And, you know, the lady that was running everything was like, okay, yep, you have a baby and we've heard the heartbeat. And my friend was like, I want to see the picture. And she was like, oh, no. We can't do that. This was like 15 years ago, back when Planned Parenthood was mm-hmm. doing their mm-hmm. thing in California. She was like, no, we can't do that. We're not going to show you that. And she was like immediately confused because she had already made up her mind. She's going to keep this baby. Like mm-hmm. she's not going into Planned Parenthood to have an abortion. She knew that going in. And then they were like, we'll just make you an appointment to schedule your abortion. And she was like, what the crap? I'm not even interested in that. And so you see that often where the indoctrination of the specific fields in the healthcare that are just compelling people like.
Well, it's broken down in demographic as well. I mean, there's an entire structure that's uncommunicated.
Absolutely.
I mean, that happened to me. That's how I ended up in Tyler. So essentially I was pregnant with my child that I planned. But I was very unconventional. I was just one of those people that I'm like, check all the boxes. It made sense. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was ready to be a mom, blah, blah, blah. Within my first trimester, I lost 30 pounds and I just couldn't keep anything down. And my skin was like ashy gray. Mm. And I was like, there is something really wrong with me. Well, I lived in Orange County, California. So everybody was like, oh my gosh, you look so great. And I was like, I'm dying.
You're dying.
I'm like, there's something wrong with me. And they're like, no, you look great. I'm like, no, I'm not supposed to be like this thin my first trimester. So I kept going back to the doctor and they were just like, no, no. I was trying to tell people and they were like, you just can't handle pregnancy. It's your first pregnancy. I was like, wow, that's brutal. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
So I just knew my body. Like, that's the one thing about millennials. I think we're a lot more in tune with our bodies. And so I just knew something wasn't right. And I would go to the hospital. It was a state-of-the-art, brand new facility in Orange County. And I would sit there and wait for sometimes 14, 16 hours to be taken back. And then they would sit me in a plastic chair and they would give me an IV and they would tell me to go home. And I would say, can you please check the baby? And they'd say no. So I went back again. And then they finally, after going back enough times, they at least let me get to a bed. And they'd give me an IV and I'd say, can I please hear the heartbeat? Can I please check the baby? And they would say no.
What?
But I would see every illegal immigrant go back and get full service, and I would see everybody come from the prison, like literally cuffed to the bed adjacent to me, and they had like nurses on them, like they were checking all their vitals, everything. And I just was thinking, like, how do I get someone to take this seriously? Like, I couldn't get a nurse or a doctor to stay in my, you know, cubicled room for longer than 8 seconds, and it was driving me insane. So my mom actually called me and she was like, are you okay? And I was like, no, I'm not. I had actually woken up to a dream. I had never had a vision before. It was the first time God had ever given me a vision. But I was laying on a mattress out in the middle of the road. And I knew that I was pregnant in the dream. And I was adjacent to my fiance at the time. And I woke up and I saw this giant dumpster rolling down the street. And I was like trying to wake him up. And I was like, we need to get up. We need to get up. We need to get up. And he was dead asleep. And I knew in that split second that I had to make a decision to either get up or that all three of us would be crushed. And so I start to get up and I wake up from the dream. And I was like, something is wrong. You need to come. And I need to leave. I think I need to leave. I need to go find somewhere where they're going to take this seriously. And so I came to Tyler, walked into a hospital. The guy goes, I bet you have a pituitary brain tumor, and walks out of the room, sends me back for an MRI. He's like, yep, that's what you have. So I was like,
yep.
Okay.
What?
I'm not crazy. It's a miracle. So I literally decided right then and there that I was staying in Tyler and never going back.
Well, how did you hear about Tyler?
So my sister and her husband had moved here. So it was during the Obama era, and jobs and housing and everything in California was very chaotic. Mm-hmm. And so he had just graduated from college, and the job that he wanted to go into had like a 3-year waiting list for an unpaid internship. He was like, I can't do that. I just got married. So he found out about a prison that was here in Texas that could take him. They're like, we'll pay to relocate you, everything. So they moved. My parents came to move them. And they were like, it's so beautiful and peaceful. I think we're going to stay. Like, we're going to move here, too. And I was like, I'm having my first child, and you all are abandoning me. What the heck? I was so mad. But I thought that all of Texas was like El Paso. I'd never been anywhere. Yeah. But El Paso.
No pine trees.
El Paso's not even that bad. Like, you know.
But it's desert.
Yeah.
Like, and when you're going from Orange County, California, to El Paso, like, it was just like, no, I will never move to Texas. Y'all are crazy. So my mom knew that I was so sick. She was like, come stay with me for a little bit. And it was. It was so peaceful and beautiful. And I just knew that's where I wanted to raise my son. And people had, like, the sweetest, kindest manners, and it was a completely different vibe than what I'd come from, and I just wanted to stay.
Shameless plug for the Yellow Rose of Texas, Tyler. It's a wonderful place. So one of the things that I've seen with the indoctrination, like, you'll even have the people who are trying to actually, like, claim to help, like, children and everything like that, they'll even be the ones to start pushing for abortions. I know it was, 12 years ago, 11 years ago, something like that. I was living in Australia. My daughter had five or six cousins all born at the same time. Like there was something in the water. That whole family was just having babies, and we were too. My sister-in-law, my ex-sister-in-law, she was pregnant and she had had, her water broke at like 21 weeks.
Mm.
And she had to be bedridden for the rest of her pregnancy. And the doctors that she had were absolutely horrible. Were pushing her like, you need to have an abortion. This child's not going to survive. It's going to have concrete lungs, all that. And because there's no water for the lungs and everything to develop. And she just prayed. We all just prayed. That was something that we all just got behind and started praying. We had people praying here. We had people praying in the UK. We had people praying all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Allie got a second opinion and left those horrible doctors. And she found another doctor who... straight up told her, was like, you're not the worst case
mm-hmm.
in this facility mm-hmm. right now. I want you to know that. Like, you are not the worst case. Like, mm-hmm. we have a lot worse situations. Just to give her some hope mm-hmm. type thing. And
there's so many miracle babies out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And he even gave a little, you know, I don't know, elbow and wink about prayer because he was a believer. And that's not something that you can talk about
right.
down there openly, right. especially. And whenever they did the sonogram, the fluid was perfectly around that baby's mouth and nose.
Wow.
Perfectly. Like you couldn't have placed it any better. And whenever, like, everybody was a little worried, you know, we were concerned, but, you know, obviously prayer was such a big thing in that aspect. And when that baby came out, she came out screaming. I mean, she and to this day, she's healthy. She still plays with my daughter. She lives in Australia right now and has not necessarily had the best life that everybody would imagine the way that they want their life. But
sure.
through God's sovereignty, through God's goodness, through God's trust and mercy mm-hmm. on us that he gives us, she has had a wonderful life in mm-hmm. comparison to the way that those previous doctors had treated her.
Mm-hmm.
And, one thing that with the whole medical field, there was a recent documentary release called The 1916 Project.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you haven't seen that, you need we'll post a link or something.
Absolutely wonderful information. Not wonderful. Actually, it's horrible to be honest, but it really gives tools for Christians. It is a documentary by Christians for Christians for the church, and to really combat this issue in our nation with information, because people don't realize that Margaret Sanger had a illegal abortion clinic in Brooklyn, New York, in Brownstown specifically. And this woman was not from there. Like, this woman was like up in Nantucket. She was up in the nicer areas talking about these, abortion methods and women's rights and how liberating it is to be able to have an abortion and all this, that, and the other. And it wasn't her demographic, her own demographic that she was going to.
Oh, sure.
She went straight to the areas where there was Blacks, Latinos, Italians, Slavs.
Undesirables.
Unfit people.
It's like people who, you know, I hear them nowadays. They're like, I don't know. I'm kind of into Marxism. And I'm like, Marxism? Wow, okay. Have you ever actually read any of the writings? Because they're just paved with so much social issues of today that you would just screech at. I mean, there's just so much racism in it. And so it just, there is so much ignorance. They grab onto these cultural aspects where they think it sounds cool, you know, a little communism, a little socialism, a little Marxism, a little whatever. And they think, Yeah, like that with the right, I always hear them say like, we'll do it right this time, you know, or like,
yeah, because there's not any examples in history or in the modern age where it's been a good thing. It's always ended up killing millions of people.
Yeah. And when it comes to the aspect of communication in this cycle, don't get me wrong, data shows us that the trend, we still need to get ahead of the trend. Like, how do we create a culture where a woman doesn't want an abortion? Mm. Yes, we have passed the heartbeat bill here in Texas, and it was a great victory for us back in, what was it, 2020 or 2021, somewhere around there. But we have watched the data progress over the last few years to wonder, like, did this deter people from wanting an actual abortion? And the answer is that it didn't. So we stopped physical abortions, but now they can order the abortion pill and and so they can have it at home. They're still going to need the DNC because it's not done correctly. Mm-hmm. They're still going to need things like, an ablation or other things that can keep them from having children in the future if they don't do it right. They don't know what's in this pill. They don't understand what it is. But to them, it's a humane way of getting what they want because there's no education as to what they're really signing up for.
Well, maybe with this 4B movement, you know, or whatever. Isn't that what it is, 4B? These girls are all shaving their head and vowing to not sleep with men for four years. I mean, like, so, like, somehow the left has figured out how to be abstinent now. They're so it's mad. That orange man, orange man president, me shave head, no sex man anymore. You know, like
I saw this great meme that was like, they were like, yes, we've seen this before. And it was like the women of Manson. And they're like, but you guys aren't a cult at all. Like, you know, it's just like,
right.
It's so ridiculous.
I think. The more that we start to actually like look into like the history of things and understanding that, you know, Charles Darwin was a racist. I do not subscribe to anything that the public schools push out for the theory of evolution. Like, I can't see it. Like, it has never made sense to me.
They can't figure out how old the Earth is.
Exactly. You know?
And then carbon dating has been proven to be problematic anyway.
It is solidly what it is, a theory.
Yes, exactly. Like, a theory. But then you start to realize whenever you see, like, Charles Darwin, Marx, you start to see all these communist authors, believers, everything that started pushing this stuff, they started believing in the lesser human. They started believing that people, there was actually sections of people in society that were unworthy of education, unworthy of rights, all these things. And the fact that our American education system had latched on to the idea of we're just perpetual accidents and, you know, just a bunch of random matter and a bunch of chemicals. Well,
if you can reduce, I just had this conversation with our oldest. We were talking about, you know, being purposeful and understanding that you were created with purpose. And when you act meaninglessly, it's because you think that you're meaningless. Mm. And so when we can work on an entire culture within a classroom and tell them that you are nothing more than a mere accident that happened, you know, through space and the earth, and take away that meaningfulness, then it's so much easier for us to be able to create them to do meaningless things and to follow a government or to follow a rule. And you know, we can get into all kinds of our own theories, like COVID was just a test to see if they could shut down the churches and other things, you know. And so we have to teach our kids to be, I always go back to the scripture verses, like if you're not teaching your kids anything but one set of verses, it's to put on the full armor of God. Like he says, stand firm and then stand firm. Like he doubles down, like how important it is to stand firm because he knows how much oppression is going to come at you and how much people want you to just throw it all on the ground and be like, yeah, this is too much for me. I'm out.
Did y'all ever sing the song, I may never march in the infantry, ride in the cavalry, shoot the artillery, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm in the Lord's army.
Yeah.
You know, look, Margaret Sanger, terrible person. She did a lot of amazing things. She convinced the people she hated to think that she was helping them by helping them kill babies.
Yeah.
So that there would be less of those people that she hated.
And to continue like the genocide that the culture was perpetuating. And people don't realize that.
Like her and her cohorts were like, we wish we could implement what Hitler did.
Yeah.
Like they were like, they were like, he was so good at it. Why didn't we think of that?
Militarizing all of this like, and getting these people thrown into concentration camps and all that kind of stuff. Like she was jealous about the fact that Hitler was able to do this. And she even had a newsletter. Or a magazine, something of that sorts, where she would have people write articles of eugenics and genocide and all these things and how to control populations.
It's all out there, but the truth of the matter is you and I both know we live in a culture where people are not prone to always doing their own research.
Right.
Like, them going and finding those articles and reading.
Right.
We know it because we're interested in the truth. But so many people just recite what they hear.
Right. Like if you actually go and look at those magazines, you will find that there were people that were in Hitler's Third Reich who were writing for all of this. They were the ones that were trying to tell people how to do it, like in a social setting. And I'm sure, like, they had some sort of, like, I don't know, aspect where you could convince a people just lying to them and convincing them to do the things on their own. So I guess both sides were probably a little bit jealous.
I think
of
the
each.
Hands of evil always, in some way, shape, or form, touch the hands of evil. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think of C.S. Lewis, Screwtape Letters, and I can't think of a more profoundly accurate work of the enemy, of how the demonic energy speaks
Absolutely.
To each other and they plan these things. And so, yeah, I think that if you look at anything that's horrific in society, in any time in culture, you'll find that it touches in some way.
Mm. Well, I think that abortion's a terrible thing, but in the same vein, like, we're dealing with a human trafficking epidemic, you know? Like, you can only sell a drug. You can only sell a drug, like, once or twice. You can sell a human until they die, you know? Or until they're used up. And I think we may have a current case right now in Smith County of somebody that's been human trafficked. You know, there's this girl that's been missing. They can't find her. And I know that you do a lot of work in the human trafficking thing. You're on, like, a task force, or you're helping them with PR. So I don't know what you're doing. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
So I do public strategy. I help to develop the trainings that go alongside that and help organizations to be able to identify and discern and then decide what to do with trafficking victims. And so specifically here in our region, it looks a little differently than the movies, right? And you're going to have really like three different sex of individuals who participate in trafficking. Some of them are going to be kids who are just obsessed with culture, right? Pimp culture. And so they want to be involved in it. They're pretty easy to catch because they're dumb enough to like put it on Instagram and stuff like that. And then you're going to have, you know, these one-offs who just find a financial means to it, right? They probably start off as drug pushers, and then they realize that they can get young girls hooked on the drugs and then they can shop them out.
Like the movie Taken, like they come off the airplane and then, you know, the guy's like, oh, I can take a picture. Can we share a cab? You know, and then.
I feel like we live in a culture where, I mean, not everyone's that smart not to go to that level. Now I say the white van is the cell phone. That's how they're accessing kids. And so it's like, hey, I'm going to build rapport. I'm going to do all the grooming things that go into any other kind of sexual abuse. And then they lure them out. And they always lure them out and give them some kind of token for connection. Like, hey, I bought you a vape, like, so we can vape together. It's cool. And over time, they change out the chemicals in the vape. And so eventually they're addicted to things like fentanyl. So when people say, does the border issue actually affect us up at the top of Texas? Absolutely. We see fentanyl in these vapes that we pick up with the girls. At that point, they're fiending so bad, they need the drugs, so they keep actually running back to the trafficker and consistently begin to be trafficked out just simply because they're addicted at that point. So it's not always like a kidnap or, you know, take across the border kind of situation. I'm not saying that those things don't happen. The other part of it is cultural. So a lot of times, if you have someone that came from talking about communism, if you grew up in communist China and you don't understand the government of America because you've only been told propaganda the majority of your life, when you fly into New York, someone meets you and says, "Hey, I'm here to protect you from the government. You know, you can't trust them. Give me your passport and I'll hold on to it for safekeeping. I've got a friend in Kansas who will get you a job and help you to get started." And they ship them off to a massage parlor where they're held and they have no form of identification. They're scared of the government because they've been sold more propaganda from the people that are holding them. All the lies
just keep adding up.
Yeah. So it's very complicated.
So could you tell us a little bit about your resources for your churches? You've also got a book, is that correct?
Yeah, so I do a lot of trainings, and I train on everything from advocacy to secondary trauma and everything in between. How I even have a voice right now is, like, beyond me, because I do several hour trainings pretty much every day this week. And I love that. I love getting to see people who are inquisitive about learning. And so that's really my heart, my passion. Over the last 5 years, we've been developing this out. Made to Walk is a website that people can go to and get these resources for free. We also have a free app where they can see the trainings, but we do a lot of workshops and things in-house as well. I built out a workbook that is specific to the story of Absalom and David. And it is particularly about the crime that happens to Tamar and how angry Absalom becomes at his father's really inability to do anything about it. And so it starts this almost like a justified anger in the beginning, and then it builds to a resentment and a pride, and it causes a war within Israel and many people lose their lives. But you see the trajectory of not only how Absalom handles it, but how David handles it. And you can see the deficit of him not handling it at all in the beginning. And then when it really hits the crux of everything, you see truly an understanding who he is to God and his humility. And as he has to, you know, flee from Israel during that time, he does a really brilliant job of identifying who he is, which is no one special. And even though he's the king and he has all of these victories underneath him, he's like, "Who are you to say they can't curse me? Who are you to say that they can't make Absalom king? If it's God's will, then, you know, he will choose Absalom." And so it's this process where I think that we need to teach churches, organizations, nonprofits to understand that helping people, first off, to be in the battle of the difficult situations help when you're doing that pre-mortem thinking, which is essentially thinking of every possible thing that could go wrong and trying to plan for that so it doesn't happen. But being in the presence of difficult situations is where the church needs to be. They don't need to be walking away from difficult situations. But also, instead of leaning into what more of our culture does today, which is self-preservation, we need to be reacting more how David reacts in humility and understanding that, you know, God's purpose is above all things. So the workbook really helps groups, small groups, to be able to process through that and ask good questions, reflect upon themselves. I also don't think that we talk to pastors enough and leadership enough about secondary trauma and about mental health. And so sometimes they are just run ragged and they feel like they are the only ones holding up the fort. And they need to take some reflection on themselves as well and to take their mental health into consideration. So it's a process of all of that. But, yeah, it's my little baby.
So this is equipping church leadership, church volunteers to deal with things like you dealt with when you were a freshman.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So instead of, "Oh no, what can we do for you? And then how is this not going to ruin our congregation, our church? You know, how is this not going to end things?" This is not necessarily an insurance policy. Rather, it's like we know that people are going to mess up.
Yeah, and there's so many complexities. It can be a youth student coming up and saying, I think I'm going to kill myself tonight. You know, like it could be, you know, finding out about an affair in your church. It can be finding out, you know, some other complexities. Like we know people are people and they bring their complexities and their issues into the church. You can't ask people to like brush it off outside and not bring it in. Like it just gets in. So it's not a matter of saying like, well, here in this church, we're not going to allow any of that stuff. It doesn't work like that.
We don't talk about that here. Doesn't work.
Yeah. You can't isolate yourself from the problems. You have to learn how to manage the issues when they occur. You hope that they're minimal or, you know, at the very least that they're not something critical, but they're incredibly likely if you're in ministry that you're going to see difficult times.
And you don't want that. You don't want, the church doesn't want to hurt somebody worse the process of trying to help them or hurt the church worse, you know?
Yeah.
So this tool is really doing a lot to help bring some light into those areas.
And I want to thank you because that's incredible, like seeing how God has worked in you.
Yeah, I mean, he redeemed your story.
Yeah, he definitely has redeemed your story 10 times over. And it's really important to factor in the fact that we don't live in a perfect world by any means. Yet, God has still used your story. And here you are developing these resources, helping other churches who may not be going through the same thing, but it's available. And I think that's really important. And I think the more that the body of Christ realizes that through our hurt, through our pain, through our struggles, then that's whenever we really, when Christ, it's like when heaven touches earth mm-hmm. at those moments. So I just want to really thank you for that.
Thank you.
So how can people reach out and get in touch with you if they want to know more about Made to Walk?
Yeah, so our website is madetowalk.org. They can download the free app, Made to Walk, or they can email Izzy, madetowalk.org.
Sweet. Well, thank you so much for coming on and hosting us at your homeschool room.
It's a wonderful learning room.
Yep.
Thank you.
And
well, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, this has been Two Dudes, One God Pod. Thanks for listening.